South Dakota voters were in a no kind of mood, at least when it comes to changing the state constitution. From SDPB, today is Wednesday, November 6th. This is In the Moment. This hour, SDPB's special election coverage continues. Lee Strubinger is with us for a look at how the state legislative races are taking shape. Then SDSU political scientists David Wiltsy and Lisa Hager join us. We'll have a look at the Electoral College and the shifting fortunes of Republicans in Congress. We also have Seth Tupper from South Dakota Searchlight alongside Jonathan Ellis from the Dakota Scout. Our Dakota political junkies will bring more analysis on the ballot questions rejected by voters. Plus, South Dakotans are sending U.S. Representative Dusty Johnson back to Congress. He joins us later in the hour. We are broadcasting live today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Well, welcome back to SDPB's special election coverage. We are going to begin this hour with Lee Strubinger, our politics and public policy reporter. He has been bringing you updates and reaction really all night. I'm not sure he's been to sleep yet. And here he is with SDPB Kirby Family Studio in the studio with me. Welcome back, Lee. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Lori. Good to be here.
I want to go back to something we talked about last night when election night started and get a recap of that now, which is really this idea of the tone of the evening, where people were at, how they were celebrating, how they were not celebrating or watching, you know, the results come in that were unfavorable to their position. Tell us a few things about what you noticed.
Well, first of all, I think there was frustration in at least the room that I was in, which was kind of where the Dusty watch party was at, and the lack of what seemed to be AP calling races here in South Dakota. The AP, the Associated Press, did call races, but there was a feeling in that room that it was kind of taking a little bit longer than they thought it should. So Dusty went up and gave his victory speech before the AP even called the race. And I think part of that was because it was getting a little bit later into the night and maybe some people were starting to file out. But certainly after he gave his speech was when people started exiting the room. And so I don't know what happened kind of after that. Right. I left around like 10:30, 11 or so. And sort of made my way back here, and then hopped over to the Icon Lounge at about 11, where folks were watching the food tax and Amendment G, and that room was mostly empty. And so I made my way to the No on Amendment G watch party, which was in you'll have to excuse me, I'm from Rapid City, but it's not close to downtown. I'll just say that in the northwestern part of the city, and you know. I'm not sure how full the room was.
It's the Ramcota?
At the Ramcota, okay, yep. The Best Western right. Ramcota. Yeah. I'm not sure how full the room was.
You've seen a concert here, right? It's over by the Denny Sanford Premier Center.
I have not seen a concert here,
actually. Okay, welcome to the East Side. all right, so you're there, and that's the where the real energy is at, the No on G folks.
We're pretty
enthusiastic
about the
night.
Despite the fact that they were starting to tear down. It was about 12:30 by the time I got there. There were still a lot of people in the room watching Fox News and the results coming in. I was there when they called the race for Trump in Pennsylvania, which was one of the swing states that people were watching. And so a lot of people were very enthusiastic. And you can kind of hear that on some tape that I gathered while I was talking to Leslie Unruh and John Hansen.
All right. So a little bit on the tone of the evening. Let's look at some interesting things. We're still at the time that we're recording this. We don't have all the Minnehaha County results yet. By the time you're listening to our 7 o'clock broadcast, those are scheduled to be out. But there are already some interesting legislative house races, especially in tribal communities. Tell me a little bit about what you've been watching.
Yeah, so a lot of the districts that do include Native American reservations are really no longer a given for Democrats here in the state. Many majority tribal community legislative districts went, you know, flipped red. District 1, which includes the Sisseton Reservation, you know, the House races there went to two Republican candidates. The senator who was running there was unchallenged, and that northeast corner really used to be a Democratic stronghold here in the state. In District 26, the Senate seat is going to Tamara Grove, who's a Republican. She unseated Democrat incumbent Sean Bordeaux, who's a member of the Rosebud Reservation. Like I said, that district includes Rosebud as well as like the city of Chamberlain. So it's not just mm-hmm. exclusively Rosebud, but it does include some of the surrounding area there. Democrat Eric Emery was able to hold on to his seat in District 26A. So that's one of those court-ordered split districts for the House there. Right. He was able to hold on to that. And then taking a look at District 27 with Pine Ridge, so not only Pine Ridge, but some of Western South Dakota, all those races went to the incumbents there. So Democrats, Red Don Foster and Pree Poirier held onto their seats, and Republican Liz May, you know, continues to win in that district as well.
But Elsie Meeks was said to be a really tough challenger for Liz May. She is highly respected mm-hmm. in her community. She did not take Liz May out of the race, though.
One of the things that I think is interesting, maybe about District 27, and then again in District 32, where we saw Democrat Nicole Urie-Balk win there were three people who were running for two legislative seats. Mm-hmm. And in the case of, you know, like a District 32, if you're a Democrat and you want to see a Democrat make it into office, you would probably only just vote for one candidate, even though you have the opportunity to vote for two. Same for potentially in District 27, where you have two Democrats who are running for office, but you're a Republican in that district, so you might just only vote for Liz May. So right. that could be how those really kind of shook out there.
Yeah, super interesting. Mm-hmm. All right.
And then another district that a district that Democrats lost was District 28A, which encompasses the Cheyenne River and Standing Rock Sioux tribes. That went to Jana Hunt, and that was previously held by Orrin Lesmeister, who was the House Minority Leader. Mm-hmm. And that's, again, one of those split districts to comply with the Voting Rights Act.
Yeah. All right, so 30-some, I think I heard Ryan Bozier say in the newscast, 30 new faces in the state legislature. We're going to see we don't know what this legislature is going to do, but we will learn fairly soon who will lead them. Tell us a little bit about how that process works, please.
Yeah, so Republican-elect representatives, they're going to be heading to Pierre on Friday, okay. on Friday afternoon to decide legislative leadership races. It could be evening, it could be morning. They're going to head there on Friday. Mm-hmm. I do know that for the Senate, Republicans there, they're going to meet Friday evening in Pierre to decide those. So by the end of Friday, we will know sort of how these particular chambers shake out. And, you know, part of the, I don't know if tension is the right word, but sure. around the number of new faces is a lot of these folks, a lot of new faces are coming from the primary election who unseated incumbents. And like you said, we're not sure what the legislative session will hold, but I will put money on it that some carbon pipeline or eminent domain topics will be definitely
right.
brought up.
Right. And so freshman lawmakers might normally sit back and let the party lead the way, but this particular group of freshman lawmakers definitely have things to say, particularly about that issue. We may see some of them in a leadership role going ahead. It's going to be interesting to watch. And mm-hmm. what do we know about the U.S. Senate election, to whether or not U.S. Senator John Thune is going to replace Mitch McConnell as leader of his party in the Senate? When will we find that out?
I'm hearing that the vote for Republican leadership in the United States Senate is going to be on Wednesday. And again, John Thune is running for that majority leader position that was held by Mitch McConnell, but so is John Cornyn of Texas.
Sure. Yeah, we've got a pretty good chance it might be a John. But
it's going to be a John, probably. Maybe. Yeah.
Your name might be John, but very different pathways forward to that. Now, Senator Thune was not in Florida for the Victory Party. He was home in South Dakota. So we'll see if that, and Governor Kristi Noem was in Florida. So we'll see if any of that has any relevance whatsoever, or if that's just a logistics.
Yeah. And I think it can't, I hate to underscore this, but, you know, again, 20 years ago, John Thune unseated Tom Daschle, who was majority leader mm-hmm. of the United States Senate at the time. And so 2 decades later, you know, he's could be filling that role. It's remarkable.
Yeah. SDPB's Lee Stribinger, thank you so much for all your reporting.
Thanks for having me.
We'll see you next time.
Yep. See ya.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The MAGA movement expanded on election night. Voters are sending Donald Trump back to the White House for the next 4 years. We're going to turn now to our first lineup of Dakota political junkies this hour for analysis. Lisa Hager is an SDSU Associate Professor of Political Science, and David Wiltsey is Professor of Political Science also at SDSU, and they are seated in SDPB's Janine Basinger studio at SDSU in Brookings. Dr. Wiltsey, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Dr. Hager, welcome as well.
Thanks.
All right, the first thing that I predicted that is wrong is that we would be talking without knowing who the presidential victor would be. There was a lot of thought that we might not know till the weekend what was happening, but this was a decisive victory, even though we went in with nearly a dead heat. Which one of you wants to kick us off with kind of what happened and how we can put into context so many swing states being in play, but then really, I hate to say it, but how quickly we found out who the winner was. What happened?
I can go ahead here first and send it over to Dave. So, you know, I think the thing that ended up being really interesting about this particular election was how Georgia and North Carolina started going, and then what that meant with the blue wall of Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. And at least for me, I did not actually stay up until the election was formally called for President Trump. But I did start to see how the proportion of remaining votes and how Harris was performing wasn't looking like she was going to be catching up in any of those states. And I think that's something that was very noteworthy with what we were seeing. And for me, I think it came down to a variety of different things, but definitely this referendum essentially on the performance of the economy.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk more about that in a minute. But first, what would you add to that, Dave Wiltsey, about how close it was going into the election and then how decisive the victory was?
Well, it was close, both going in and coming out of the election. I mean, remember, we're talking about the aggregation of a bunch of states here. And in states like Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, we're only talking a percent or 2 points between the two candidates. So it is decisive in our new standard of, do we find out within a week?
Right, yeah.
But it, you know, still a fairly close election, a fairly evenly divided electorate. We have just gotten used to very close elections over the past 8-10 cycles.
Yeah.
And that kind of is not the norm historically. I mean, I'm not talking, you know, about 1984 style blowouts, but there's usually a very comfortable electoral victory for the winning candidate over the course of our history. We are just close now.
Yeah.
It's just where we are in terms of how strong partisan identity is shaping our vote.
And that's the direction I want to take this in next, because when I say decisive, I do mean, like, we know the answer. But it's not decisive in the sense that it was a landslide or a mandate, or we live in a plural, you know, democracy where we are going to be working with a lot of people who voted for the other candidate. And how are the ways that we do that in a democracy? It was a close race. There are a whole lot of people who are disappointed today, and their voices are going to matter going forward. And yet we see some leadership shifts in Congress that might be relevant. So that's the direction I kind of want to go here. And Lisa, what do we know about, you know, when the Senate and the White House are led by the same party? And then we guess I'm not really sure where the House is at or is going to be at. Is that going to make a difference?
Well, I think right now we're seeing the Republicans looking to take over the Senate and then also obviously be in control potentially of the House as well. You know, it's just kind of seeing what will happen. And I think when you do have the unified government like that, doesn't necessarily mean that everything just flies through, even though you do have the one party controlling these branches branches of government in these different chambers. There may still be some folks that need to decide if they want to work that closely with President Trump and his agenda and whatnot. But for the most part, it is going to make it a lot easier than having to deal so much with, you know, possibly divided government or even split control between the Democrats and the Republicans of the chambers of Congress. So,
yeah.
I think, like, that's where some of this decisiveness can come in, where, you know, when you have one party kind of controlling things, then it is more decisive.
Yeah, but there's still checks and balances. Dave Wiltsey, what does that look like when the Supreme Court has largely been, you know, influenced by Donald Trump's previous presidency? Now we mm-hmm. see what's happening in the Senate. So there are a lot of people who would say, hey, this is, there's a lot of control. There's a lot of opportunity to get an agenda in America that might be what he's been talking about on the campaign trail. Whether you're excited for that or you're mortified by it, there's an expectation that there are possibilities that weren't before, but yet we also have these three branches of government who are supposed to watch each other, help the college students in the room figure out how to look at some of these things in the days ahead, the months ahead.
Well, the court's clearly not a check any longer. I mean, they have very consistently ruled in the president's favor, you know, up to and including near absolute immunity in any kind of official act. So they're out. The Senate, we still have Rule 23 there. Are they going to be willing to junk the filibuster and change the rules of cloture for routine legislation? That's something that Thune or Conran or whoever winds up as majority leader is going to have to decide. There's no telling if they're willing to do that or not, and how much pressure the president will be putting on them to do so. That's an open question. So the Senate is, you know, definitely a potential roadblock here. And as far as the House goes, even if there is, if it breaks their way, you know, we're going to be talking about a very slight majority here. The Republicans might improve by a few seats, but remember, very rarely is every single elected member of the House of Representatives actually in the House. There's almost always a vacancy, even on day one of each new Congress. So every vote counts, and keeping that caucus together is still going to be hard. It is still going to be a hard slog for leadership. And it probably is easier now for Speaker Johnson, but it's still going to be a challenge for him to keep some of his more recalcitrant members under control and some of his more vulnerable moderates that are still in the party in competitive districts that could turn the institution in the midterm. So it'll be an interesting few weeks as we kind of see how this shakes out and how, you know, what the leadership decisions are going to be and what the rule changes might be.
Yeah. So U.S. Senator John Thune has not been best friends with Donald Trump in the past. They've had their issues. What's his play here? What does he do next if he is chosen to lead the Senate? Dave, you'll start with you and we'll go to Lisa next. Yeah.
It probably would be something along the lines of Mitch McConnell. It won't genuflect the president, but, I mean, he will have to supplicate himself to a certain degree. He is going to have, you know, some more Trump allies in his caucus, and he's going to have to keep them happy.
Yeah. Lisa, you would add to that anything?
There's not really too much to add there. I think Dave put it really well that, yeah, for the most part, you do have to play ball with the president, and you got to placate those folks within your party who tend to agree with him in order to accomplish things.
Yeah. One of the things we forget often as casual observers of politics is these party leaders in Congress, they have to keep their caucuses together, and that can be very difficult. And in the Senate, too. I mean, what are we looking at now, a 52 or 53 Republicans being elected, most likely? That's, again, not a big majority.
All right. What does this election say about who we are as America right now? What, when you woke up this morning, were you reflecting on still after you watched or checked in on the results as they came in? Lisa?
I think for me, I found it interesting as I was watching CNN last night and how they were breaking down what issues were important to voters in each of the states. And the economy and democracy were continually ranking as the top two issues. And I think this definitely came down to probably those issues, but also some of the others that were thrown in the mix relating to abortion and immigration. But I think those two won out. And I think obviously the record inflation that we've had in the past 4 years broke towards Trump. And I think what was getting missed was this issue relating to democracy, where a lot of the interpretation had to do with Trump being a threat to democracy. But I think what was getting missed is that there were a lot of people in the past 4 years feeling like their viewpoints were not being taken into account and were oftentimes being called wrong by the Democrats and the Biden administration. And I think that also broke towards Trump's favor. So looking at this issue of democracy one way, I think, was missing some of the point of what happened with this election.
Yeah. What would you add, Dave?
I would say that this is, in many respects, a very typical election. When it comes to which way undecided voters break and, you know, who kind of makes and breaks an election and makes a majority for a presidential candidate, is the economy, and more importantly, people's perception of the economy, is one of those driving factors, as is presidential popularity. And all of this is kind of through the lens of partisanship. And in this, in this election, you had a very, very unpopular president. Joe Biden was about as unpopular of an incumbent as we've had, probably in my memory, if not lifetime. The economy, I mean, despite some very good things happening comparatively around the world, there were people who were hurt, people who were feeling the pressure from inflation. And the impression of folks was, the economy is struggling. And when those two things are working against the incumbent president, people in his party are punished. And in some respects, I think it's remarkable that Kamala Harris came this close to Donald Trump in the overall popular vote and in some of these so-called blue wall states, where you have at the Rust Belt areas that have been really hard hit in the last 20 years economically. The fact that she kept it that close was kind of surprising to me.
Yeah. All right. What do Republicans have to do next? What do Democrats have to do next? Very briefly, in like 30 seconds, what's the recovery plan or the plan to prove it that they can do what they said they were going to do when they got elected?
Stick together. I mean, just keep their caucuses intact. Do whatever they can to put themselves in the best position possible for the midterm. Dems probably are going to pick up seats, and they might even flip both chambers if things break their way, as they very often do historically.
Yeah. All right. We're going to leave it there. Dave Wiltsey, Lisa Hager, professors at South Dakota State University, always insightful to have you on the air with us. Thanks so much for being here.
Great to be here.
Thank you.
Dakota Political Junkies for more post-election analysis. Seth Tupper is editor-in-chief of South Dakota Searchlight, and he is with us now from SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City. Hey, Seth.
Hey, Lori. Thanks for having me.
And with me here in Sioux Falls, Jonathan Ellis, co-founder of the independent news journal The Dakota Scout. He's here in the Kirby family studio. Welcome back, Jonathan.
Thanks for having me.
All right. You're awake. You're alert. Everybody's had a long night, but I on behalf of all South Dakota listeners, thank both of you. I know how hard you've been working and how late you've been up, and to come and provide analysis is a service to the people. So thank you for doing that.
Thank you.
Where do you want to begin? We haven't really gotten together to talk about any prep stuff, so I want to make sure that we pivot to your priorities and the things that caught your attention on election night. And Jonathan, let's start with you. What stands out as something that really maybe has not been discussed enough, or that was a real surprise or important revelation of last night's election?
Well, we're still diving into the legislative races there, but the ballot issues, of course, I think are the news item of the day, and the enormity of these losses. I mean, these were I think if on my post show or pre show predictions predicted a lot of the outcomes, but the enormity of these losses are to me amazing.
Yeah, Seth, what comes out for you that you want to start with here?
Yeah, I think for me, the margin of defeat for Amendment G, the abortion rights measure, to me was especially glaring and surprising. You know, in a state where in 2006 and 2008, the voters of South Dakota rejected abortion bans by about 55% each time. And so, you know, judging by that history, I thought there would be more support for that. Not necessarily surprised that it lost, given the anti-abortion side had appeared to have more money and was better organized, and the abortion rights side was splintered into factions, with some groups that would typically be expected to support this amendment didn't, you know, Planned Parenthood and ACLU, et cetera. But to go down, by 20 points. After so many other abortion rights measures had passed, you know, since the Dobbs decision, to me that was kind of the story of the night. And then, as you know, another kind of sub story is that we're still waiting for election results in Minnehaha County. Ever as far as I know, I haven't checked lately since I've been waiting to go on the air. But that's another story that is especially perplexing and is keeping us from really fully understanding what's happened in the legislative results.
Yeah. Update on that, Jonathan. We're live right now at 12:30 Central, 11:30 Mountain. If you're listening to the 7:00/6:00 broadcast, you already know these results. But right now, it's 12:30, and the one thing that we're waiting for, Jonathan, we thought maybe we'd be waiting to know who president was. No, we're waiting for Minnehaha County instead.
I knew this was going to happen. No,
you did.
And we're actually, as we speak right now, we're breaking a story about some issues going on in Minnehaha County. That's going up at the DakotaScoutNow.com now. So there's...
What do you mean issues? I feel like in election integrity land, we need to be a little more specific than issues. You don't have to tell us the whole story, but...
A box of ballots or so and some problems that have happened with that that were apparently counted or not counted, but put in the counted pile. So,
okay.
I don't know how many ballots we're talking about that there, but
developing story now, listeners. So,
correct.
Check in on that later. Yeah.
This has been a longstanding problem in Minnehaha County. This isn't new. This has been going on, and I've already talked to some lawmakers today about this, and there are changes I think that could be made in state law that could clear some of these issues up in terms of what can be counted when and you know, what can be done before. Yeah, other states do this a lot differently, in my experience, and have a lot more streamlined method of counting votes and getting results to people. I think Florida was done before we even counted a single ballot or reported a single ballot in Minnehaha County last night, if I got that right. I mean, obviously they're a little bit ahead of us in a time zone, but it's a huge, huge state.
I want to go back to Amendment G a little bit and talk about the efforts to, because what I'm curious about is has the South Dakota electorate changed in their opinions from what we know the ways they were voting before? Is it just, you know, culturally we're shifting? Or was there a really effective campaign, especially at the end, from the anti-G forces that said, you might think the law needs to be changed, but this is not the way to do it. They didn't get the people on the ground. They didn't have Planned Parenthood, shockingly, on their side. That was something that we covered. And then this huge influx of cash from the Catholic Church, which in Sioux Falls showed up, I think, in a lot of billboards that were sort of softly reminding you to love babies. So there were just a lot of grandmothers love babies, real men love babies, real South Dakotans love babies. So you were surrounded by this sort of pink and blue billboard campaign, which, you know, I'm not sure all of that came from the Catholic Church, but I know they did donate a lot of money to the No on G cause. So is it the messaging? Or are we just done talking about abortion because South Dakotans have decided this is something that they do not want?
I'm going to point to two things. First off, I think if you looked at this campaign and evaluated it compared to other ones across the nation in which abortion rights prevailed, you will find that the right to life groups got way outspent. And I think this is going to be the anomaly in which you mentioned the money. So I agree, the money played a role. Secondly, Seth mentions the 06 and 08 votes. Mm-hmm. Okay. What voters said, in 06 and 08, South Dakota already had some of the most restrictive abortion laws in the country. We've just always had. And what we have now that was going to be replaced was not what we had in, the Dobbs decision. I mean, that this was going to be much, much different than what the state had had in 06, 08. And so
because the state had added these other pieces of legislation saying this, you have to read this language as somebody, or you have to wait. That's what you're referring to.
Yeah. And there were, I mean, I think it was a 15 or 16 week, it was a much more restrictive law environment in that time. And maybe you can say, hey, voters are willing to live with a window, but they're not willing to live with the window that a constitutional amendment was going to provide here as wide, So I think that those are two issues that played a role in this.
Seth, what do you think happened?
I think the ad you mentioned to me to understand what happened here, you look at those ads that were run where there's one in particular with a woman dressed as a nurse, whether she was a nurse or not, I don't know, but looking into the camera saying our laws may need to be changed, right, but Amendment G is too extreme. I think that tells you about everything you need to know about what happened here. I think somebody on the anti-abortion side was smart enough to realize that there is still a large number of folks out there who maybe don't want the total ban and don't like our current law that only has one exception to preserve the life of the mother. So they recognize that and they played into that. While those of us who have covered the legislature in the last couple of years realize that we've had a couple sessions where they could have changed the law if they wanted to, where people could have worked on that, and they didn't. Mm-hmm. So I'm really interested in that going forward, because obviously that advertisement was kind of an indicator that, hey, people on both sides realize that there's maybe everybody's not entirely comfortable with the current law, but. And that was used to the benefit of the anti-abortion side in this campaign. But now what? Is anybody actually going to come forward and make good on that sort of quasi-promise to work on our current law?
Yeah. Now what? That's the next question. I mean, let's talk about rape victims, rape survivors. And Chrissy Noem has said, I think she was very quickly asked after a 10-year-old sort of famous story from another state. And she said, don't add another tragedy on top of a tragedy. So I believe that it's safe to say, even in the event of an underage child being raped, that she would not necessarily say it's time to allow abortion. She would say, we're going to allow services to sort of help this child through the thing. Is that, do you think, what the legislature believes, what the people of South Dakota believe? What are we to do with rape victims, Jonathan?
I think given the result of last night, despite the campaign and that messaging, I think it'll be hard after the results for anybody, for a certain significant number of lawmakers to take that and say, well, we need to add some exceptions or whatever. I just don't know that.
But before, part of the reason they didn't want to do that was because they wanted to get to the Supreme Court. Well, there is no more Roe. So it seems hard to me to also believe that nobody would hear from their constituents that was something that they wanted addressed. And you think, no, there's just not really going to be any appetite politically for rape and incest exceptions.
Well, you look at the result from last night, and there's not that it doesn't exist now, and I think if you had some of those lawmakers in here, they would be saying, "Well, the people just spoke politically."
Yeah, Seth, you agree with that?
Yeah, well, I think they may be hearing from their constituents, but they'll also be hearing from South Dakota Right to Life and others who wield a lot of political power, and because of that, we saw the last two sessions, there wasn't any appetite to change the law as it is, so. As Jonathan said, given this result, a 60-40 defeat for an abortion rights amendment, while there may be an appetite among the general populace of South Dakota for changing the law, I don't know that there's going to be an appetite among legislators.
How about
for
appetite
that.
For further restrictions, out-of-state travel bans, IVF, birth control? Is there a next extension to this? Do you hear, Seth, an appetite politically for that?
I don't know. I mean, one thing I do know is obviously we still have all the same people and forces in South Dakota that worked for decades to make abortion laws as restrictive as they could possibly make them. All those same forces are still around, and I don't assume they're just going to declare victory and go home and stop working on this issue. So you'd have to think maybe those kinds of things would pop up, but you know, I kind of doubt that there'll be much of a that'll get much of an audience this session. Maybe there'll be a cooling off period for that. I don't know, but I guess that's a really interesting question. I really haven't had time to ponder that, but yeah, that'll be something.
Because it can
really
get more restrictive, and if this is this is the place where, you know, we are pushing politically, it's a really easy way to raise money. So you could push it any further, yeah.
Yeah, and as I said, I mean, you know, when the Dobbs decision came down, the folks on the anti-abortion side again didn't just say, "Well, we're done now," and I don't think they're going to say that after last night either.
Jonathan, how about marijuana? Recreational marijuana fails. Are we done talking about it?
The people who were behind this effort said that if it failed, they would be done. So I mean that's not to say another group could come along and try to do that, but I mean I think it's now, you could argue that hey this vote was good to take this to the voters after the kind of the mess up in 2020 and so forth, and now I see like there's some finality to it.
Yeah, Seth, do you agree with that one?
Yeah, I mean, I would also say that, the ultimate resolution to this might come at the federal level. As we know, there are some efforts at the federal level to, change some marijuana laws and regulations and things. And, nationally, there's still the movement continues toward a legalization movement. So, we clearly weren't ready for it in South Dakota. Voters weren't ready for it. But just because of what we said at the state level doesn't mean that things won't continue progressing on the federal level.
Yeah. Anything that's standing out to either one of you about the state legislative races? We don't have all the results yet, especially in Minnehaha County. But any other districts, Seth, maybe from where you're at, that are popping up that are of interest to you?
Yeah, one that was a great surprise out here. And, we fall victim to this where, Democrats have so little success in the legislature. When they do, it really grabs maybe an inordinate amount of attention. So, But Nicole Urey-Balk, a Democrat out here, appears to have won a seat in the District 32 House race, and we're still compiling this and working on a story, but, Democrats don't win legislative seats in the Black Hills, basically in the last couple decades. It's just not something that happens. So for her to do that was a real surprise. That was one real surprising result out here. And she raised a lot of money. She was very visible, did a lot of hard work. I saw her at a lot of community events. She ran really hard, and I don't know, maybe there's some kind of a hope there for Democrats in a template that she can give them. But that was one really surprising result out here.
Yeah. Looks like the Democrats are going to lose seats overall, though, yeah? Yeah. I'm not counting a lot.
going to the legislature, not the races, but the legislature now with the food tax outcome will not have to deal with as many new members that were coming in. Mm. If they had to come and deal with that issue, that would have been a real mess.
So what are they going to – it's too soon to say this because we don't know who the leadership's going to be, for example. But, we do know through the primaries and some of the names on the list. What are some of the things that we think might come out of the state legislature this upcoming session? Jonathan?
The expectation is that it will be more conservative legislature.
Yeah, what does that mean, though?
More some of the conservative leaders in the
like
conservative
fiscally,
faction.
Like we're going back to pipeline conversation that gets kicked out.
I think
are we talking socially? What do you mean?
Social. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and then they're fiscal conservatives as well. So.
Yeah.
I mean, you're talking about the pipeline. There will be less of a desire among what I think is going to emerge as the leadership to work with them as there was in the last legislative.
Right. So they don't have to tackle abortion. They don't have to deal with the food tax. What are the other social issues that you think that these freshman lawmakers are enthusiastic about tackling?
You know, to be honest, I have not been talking about, you know, they've been focused on winning their elections and then the leadership races that are coming right up. And then I think from there they can start to think about where they're going to set an agenda.
Yeah. Seth, any insight into upcoming agendas perhaps?
Yeah, I think you know, among the crop of new legislators that are coming in, and especially speaking for the ones out here in the Black Hills, property rights. It's all about property rights, property taxes, holding those in check, property rights of landowners affected by pipelines, et cetera. A lot of people out here, I've said this before, but I'm just amazed at the extent to which legislators out here ran on the property rights pipeline issue when the pipeline won't come within 300 or 400 miles of the Black Hills. But it was a huge issue out here, and a lot of legislative candidates talked about it an awful lot. And so whether, you know, depending on who wins the leadership and that whole dynamic, you know, will determine how much that's actually dealt with. But surely a lot of the new legislators want to make that an issue.
Yeah.
Well, and Seth touched upon this, but there is a property tax revolt of brewing out there.
Yeah.
And if they don't figure something out on property taxes, you're going to get some reaction.
That seems to me to be a safe bet. Even more so than a social issue is those property taxes. And I'm very curious to see how Governor Noem works with either the new administration or the new state legislators. More to come. Jonathan Ellis.
Much more.
Yeah. with the Dakota Scout, thanks for being here.
Thanks.
Seth Tupper, thank you.
You bet.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. U.S. Representative Dusty Johnson won big on election night. The incumbent Republican will go back to Washington with new colleagues and a mandate to do just a few things, including funding the government, securing a new farm bill, and working on immigration reform. He joins us now on the phone for a post-election recap. Representative Johnson, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Tell me a little bit about the celebratory nature of the night, but then also the mantle of the massive amount of work that needs to be done.
Yeah, I mean, elections are basically job interviews, and so you do want the job interview to go well, particularly if you've already got the job. You want the voters, the bosses, to hire you for another 2 years. Clearly, we do have a lot of work to do, and so I'm probably focused more on how do we actually put together the coalitions we need to get that done as opposed to celebrating. But, yeah, it's always good to have at least one good night to think about it.
Before we go on to the coalition building and what will happen in Washington, speak a little bit to the voters who cast their ballot for Sheryl Johnson, more than 100,000 people who thought she spoke for them, and now you're representing them as well. What's your message to them?
Well, Sheryl Johnson did the whole system a real service. In our republic, the voters have the power, but of course they only have the power, Lori, if they actually get a choice. Sheryl Johnson gave them a choice. I thought she ran a spirited campaign. She brought up a lot of legitimate policy issues. She and I had a lot of differences of opinion, but she was never nasty. Mm-hmm. I thought she did the whole system a real service. And of course I tried to respond in kind. And I think that many of her voters would acknowledge that, you know, she and I had a good campaign, and that even if they disagree with me, they think I'm a good guy who's going to work hard for South Dakota and work hard for America. And of course, I know it was a big night for Republicans, and I am excited about that. But let's remember that Republicans don't have 60 votes in the Senate. And in fact, in this country's history, Republicans have never had 60 votes in the Senate. The filibuster is still an important mechanism in the Senate, and that means we if we are going to pass bills, we're going to need to try to find some common ground. And I think Sheryl Johnson's voters will understand and appreciate that.
All right, let's talk about a new farm bill. Where do you begin now, or where do you begin next? Where do you go next?
Democratic Chair Stabenow in the Senate has not released any text for a farm bill. That's been a big part of the holdup. She must have been waiting for the election. I'm not quite sure why, but I assume that was the delay. So I think one of two things is going to happen, Lori. Either they've got a farm bill in the Senate ready to go, which they can introduce and hopefully move on quickly. We have passed our House version out of the House Ag Committee on a bipartisan basis. Or if they really just don't have that bill ready in the Senate, then the Republicans are going to take control here in January, and they are going to like a lot of what we did in the House with our farm bill. So I think the good news is we are getting, we're in the fourth quarter. I don't know whether we're at the beginning of the fourth quarter or at the end, but we're clearly getting a lot closer to having 5 years of predictability, at least on policy, for our producers.
Yeah. All right. President-elect Donald Trump has talked about tariffs that might impact farmers with that in mind. And with the things that you just said about the challenges of building a coalition, what do you want to see for South Dakota farmers in a new farm bill?
Well, I think we want to acknowledge the unfortunate inflationary environment we've been in. A lot of our insurance-type products are based on what does it cost to grow the crops, to raise the livestock. That is dramatically different than it was 6 or 7 years ago. And so our House committee passed farm bill did account for that. I'm a big believer in working lands conservation. We've got to have water quality and soil health. We need to have habitat. You can do those things in acres that aren't necessarily idled. That doesn't mean that there isn't a role for the CRP program. But we do want to have a lot of emphasis also on working lands conservation. So we're serving those important stewardship masters, and our bill does that. Clearly, rural broadband is a big deal. Clearly, making sure that we've got a fair livestock market's a big deal. And also trade market access. You brought up tariffs. I would mention that we export $5 billion of agricultural goods to other parts of the world. They're hungry for our beef, beans, corn, and dairy, and we should make it easier for other folks to give South Dakotans money to buy our good food.
We are hearing again and again in analysis that the economy was a really important reason that people voted the way that they did yesterday. How will you and your party fix, in quotation marks, the economy? And obviously that's a blunt question for a nuanced answer, but give me something that you think you'd like to tackle in our remaining 2 minutes right away that will address some of those problems that Americans are frustrated with economically.
We don't need to take my word for it. The broad consensus of economists acknowledge that hyperinflation was triggered when we dramatically overspent $10 or $12 trillion of loose money from the Federal Reserve or from spending, I mean, giveaways from the federal governments. We're starting to see some of that inflation come down because the last 2 years have not featured those trillion-dollar social packages because we've been in the era of divided government. Republicans in the House have blocked more of those giveaways. So I just mentioned that, Lori, because some of the healing has already begun as we have stopped with the trillion-dollar packages. I think the next step would really make sure that we continue to find some efficiencies in government while acknowledging that there are areas where government spends money in areas like education where we can really help the economy grow.
All right. Well, we will leave it there and let you get back to work. I know you've been busy and talking to a lot of people, so we appreciate you showing up for the listeners of SDPB. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was U.S. Representative Dusty Johnson. He won big on election night. That is our show for today. We hope that it served you. On tomorrow's In the Moment, we are going to have another conversation about AI. And this one is a tech radio conversation. We'll spend the hour really unpacking AI tools, what our experts are seeing hit the market, some of the problems with them, and we'll get a little spirited about when you should say yes to AI and when you should say no. We also have a great conversation coming up on Friday about Kenny Higoshi, the Japanese-American resident in Spearfish, South Dakota, World War II veteran. So we're going to kick you off for a Veterans Day weekend with that. From all of us here at SDPB, thank you to the SDPB crew who worked very hard on election night. I'm Lori Walsh. On behalf of all of us, thanks for listening.